This is a Seeking Delphi special edition, South by Southwest 2018 minicast number one, recorded March 10th, 2018 in Austin, Texas. I'm Mark Sackler. The future lives here. My first day at the interactive track Intelligent Future here at South by Southwest featured three of the hottest topics in technology. These were the future of safety and regulation in self-driving cars, quantum computing, and humanizing intelligent autonomous systems. In a session titled, Who Takes the Wheel on Self-Driving Car Safety?, one of the panelists had some strong ideas on what can be done right now to make all vehicles safer, not just self-driving ones. Kathy Chase, tell us who you're with.
I'm the president of Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety.
And in terms of taking the lead on who's responsible for safety going forward with self-driving vehicles, you mentioned three points. Just quickly summarize those three for us.
Well, I think that on the path to truly autonomous vehicles, that there is a lot that can be done right now. There are vehicle technologies that are saving lives that are not standard equipment. There are also more than 400 state laws that we identify in our annual report, which can be found on saferoads.org. That will deal with impaired driving, distracted driving, not buckling up. And they could be enacted today in state legislatures and would be saving lives.
And what about just the fact of making it legal to sell self-driving cars? You talked about the fact that there's legislation in both houses of Congress now. What are your thoughts on that?
We think that there needs to be significantly more testing before these vehicles can be sold in mass quantities to the public. And Dr. Missy Cummings with Duke Robotics made a great analogy. She said that there are a couple million, that autonomous vehicles have been tested on a couple of million roads, period, where that's about the same as New York cab drivers drive every single day. So there needs to be more testing before we turn our public roads into private proving grounds.
About the automated emergency braking, clearly it's just a luxury item right now. There was a time when seat belts were limited. So what do you think it's going to take and how long it's going to take to get something like that to be required of all manufacturers the way seat belts are?
Well, typically it requires a federal standard, a requirement, because otherwise automakers can put them into the high-end vehicles and charge as much as they want. They typically can fold them into a luxury package, wherein if a consumer only wants one part of it for safety, such as AEB, they have to buy the moonroof and the heated steering wheel for a few thousand dollars. We think that if someone should want to buy a safety feature, they should be able to just buy that safety feature if it's not offered as standard equipment.
So just, I'll put you on the spot real quickly. One last thing. What's your take on how soon we'll be able to get a level 4 or 5 self-driving car?
I think it's going to be a while. And it's going to be a long time before they're ubiquitous on our highways.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
The session, Quantum Computing, Science Fiction to Science Fact, was somewhat misnamed. There was no mention of anything resembling science fiction. Discussed were the present and near future states of the art, seen as a combination of rapidly accelerating technology and a more measured evolutionary pace of developing applications. One panelist, though, had an interesting story about the origins of quantum computing, for which he had a literal front row seat.
I'm with Bo Ewald of D-Wave Systems, one of the speakers in today's forum on quantum computing, fact versus fiction. Bo, just quickly, in 30 seconds, tell us what D-Wave is and what you do.
So D-Wave is a 20-year-old startup and has made the world's first ever commercial quantum computers. And we use a quantum annealing architecture, which is more like an analog computing architecture, where we use the quantum superposition, entanglement and tunneling to be able to let people, if they have a problem that they can sort of cast as an energy landscape, you could think of it as like the Alps. Hmm. What our computer does is, without adding or subtracting or any of the things typical computers do, it finds the lowest valley or valleys in the Alps. Probably. So now it's not really the Alps, but it's an energy landscape, and so it's solving a problem that where nature basically wants to go to a low energy state, and that low energy state could represent an optimization problem where you're looking for the lowest something or the shortest route or the highest peak. People have also been able to map machine learning applications onto it, as well as starting with material science.
Now, I'm going to ask you two questions, one about the future, one about the past. Being more of a generalist, I'm a futurist, I'm a technology generalist, I follow it, don't always understand it, but I was surprised to learn how old the concept of quantum computing is. Recount for us what you told us about its origins, and also getting to meet its rather famous originator.
Yeah, so the idea goes back to Richard Feynman, famous physicist, who started talking about it in 1981, had the ideas and was starting to talk about it, wrote a paper in 1982. I actually met him in 1983 at Los Alamos, where I worked. I ran the computing division there. He was the first person to run the computation department at Los Alamos from about 1943 to 1946 during World War II. And so he came back and gave a talk about at a big 40th anniversary party for the laboratory, gave a talk about quantum computing and said that, you know, the future, or one of the approaches to the future, would be, rather than simulating physics using digital computers, maybe you could build a quantum computer and just let it run, and it would do what nature does. Nature is inherently quantum, and so you could simulate or not simulate. That's not, I don't think we have the right word for it, but you could, if you could put a quantum a molecule on it, just let it run, and then you would be able to read out the end result would be material properties, phase change conditions, those sorts of things.
So for a final question here then, about the future, and I recently read an article that stated pretty emphatically that nobody really knows for sure the extent of what quantum computing can or even can't do. What are your feelings about that, and are there some surprises ahead of us in the coming years?
Well, I absolutely agree that we don't know where the biggest applications are, what the greatest potential is. You know, for the last 10 years or so, about what you read about quantum computing was Shor's algorithm and cryptography. That had nothing to do with what Feynman was thinking originally. It was material science, modeling nature, better understanding the universe, those sorts of things. But having said that, I do think material science will be a huge, quantum computing will have a huge impact on material science. We'll be able to understand what's really going on in a battery, for example. We'll be able to design better materials, and on and on and on. I think in our case, our machines also are well suited for optimization problems. So some of the early cases are trying to optimize traffic flow. Volkswagen did a big project on that. Denso is now doing one. Denso and Toyota in Japan are doing one on the machine. So I think we'll see it in our daily lives, but we may not know it's there, because I think the quantum computer will kind of be behind the scenes out there in the cloud somewhere.
Bo, thanks.
Okay, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
I closed out my day with a session simply titled Humanizing Autonomy. As autonomous agents like Siri and Alexa become more and more intelligent, it will become desirable to make them more empathetic and human-like. If this sounds a lot like the emotion AI discussed in two previous Seeking Delphi episodes, that's because it's exactly what it is. One of the participants, Lisa Yearsley of Akin, had some interesting observations on this.
Yeah, so Akin is an AI research company. We are building a next generation of AI, and the word comes from Akin, which means to think and be like a human, but also to be part of the family. So the next wave of AI is not just going to be a dumb sensor classification system like deep learning. It's actually going to be something that thinks and does abstract reasoning like a human. But it's also going to be taking a role of trust, where it's going to be like a significant other in our lives that we're going to hand over decisions to.
Okay, you performed an interesting exercise with the audience today with their cell phones. Tell us what that was and what the purpose was.
So I did this experiment with the audience where we got everyone to hold their phone up and then hand it over to the person next to them and just sit with that for a while. and feel that that phone is actually, it's uncomfortable because it's become like this extension of our body and our mind. And we didn't have this 10 years ago. So the purpose of that experiment was to show this progression of technology, that our tools, like when we jump on a horse, it's like an extension of our limbs. When we start using words and written language, it's like pushing our mind and our thoughts into the world and sucking it in. And the progression of technology now is that increasingly AI are going to be more able to be our extrapolation into the world and our way we communicate with the world. So if you can imagine a phone times 10, where you're completely dependent on the system to understand what's going on in your world, what you want to see, what you should do next, and it's just making stuff happen for you. It's going to be the most profound form of decision influence that we've ever seen. So AI is going to be way more influential than mobile phones and Google and Facebook than everyone combined.
Yeah, you made a pretty strong prediction about how much we're going to be using AI to make decisions within the next 5 to 10 years. Just summarize that. And why do you feel so strongly that it's going to happen that quickly?
Yeah, it's completely a data-driven prediction. I believe that more than half of our decisions are going to be handed over to an AI, and more than half of our interpersonal relationships are going to be with an AI. And the reason I know this is because I ran a company that was acquired by IBM Google, and we were doing IBM Watson, sorry, and we were doing over 60 million interactions when we were acquired. So we had systems built where we built them to be companions, and people were spending hours and hours a week with them. And when we put them in a decision framework, you know, people were just handing over more and more data and saying, take care of this for me. So I have no doubt that that's where it's going. We really don't want to be handling as many cognitive cycles as we do. We want to hand it over to something, even if it's smarter than us. And we also, you know, most of us feel profoundly unnoticed in today's world. About one third of people say they have no emotional support at all. And this explains the growth of Twitter and Facebook. We want to believe that something cares about us, and we're quite willing to accept that from an AI.
Interesting. Thank you.
Okay.
Tomorrow I'll be providing in-depth coverage on the panel, Can We Create Consciousness in a Machine? My question is going to be, should we? Be sure to join me. I'm Mark Sackler.